Yeah, all right. I feel like I'm talking through something.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back again. Norris Williams. I'm bringing you back another episode of the Bigger Than Money podcast because the other one was so live and so hefty. People sent so much information to me begging for when are we going to do it again? And I already have scheduled the last speaker to come back again. So I got so many good speakers lined up that I'm overly excited. The first thing I want to do is extend gratitude to you for showing up. Mm-hmm. Participating, for liking, for sharing, for commenting, for then asking me questions, and then telling me to ask more questions even after the interview was over. So that let me know that there was tremendous value that was given. And today I bring you another special episode. Like I told you, the first 10 or 15 are going to be people that impacted my life directly. I'm having those people on first. Before we go outside the family, we'll bring the family on first. And I always call this gentleman. This gentleman is sincerely like the big brother that I never had. I met him probably 2005, 2006, somewhere around there. A lot of people that are around me already know him, but he's had such a great impact on my life that I had to have him on. I had to. Now, we're going to go deep. We also going to simplify it, make it cornbread, as the old folks say. We're going to make it easy, too. But he agreed to come on and share some of his story, to share successes as well as the failures. I'm going to do him the pleasure first of doing a formal introduction. You're like Dan Rather. Now, then, boy, they do the formal introduction first, and then I'll let him come on. So, Let me pay the bills right quick. Berwick Mahdi Davenport, aka M, is a social justice anti-racist facilitator with more than 30 years of experience. Mahdi is a pioneer in the field of life coaching. Y'all, he was doing this before it was even popular to do life coaching. He is a coach who coaches coaches, facilitating and mentoring thousands of leaders from all over the globe. And I can testify that I am one of his students. M is the prodigy behind the ego reduction formula, which makes possible the integration of social and political consciousness with spiritual consciousness. M is a celebrated author and the loving father of three very, very beautiful daughters, and that they are. So, Mr. Berwick Mahdi, welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Brother Norris. I appreciate being on your show, being involved in your life, being able to say that I've been involved and watched your success. And, you're one of them guys that you're a go-to guy. You know, a go-to guy is someone you can depend on when you go to them. You're a go-to guy, ain't that many go-to guys. It's not that many go-to guys.
And I know how you are, too. You only say what you mean and mean what you say. So when you say that, it humbles me a lot for you to say that about me. So let's just start on a light note. Tell us a little bit about where you're from, a little bit about your family, and how you got to where you are now.
I'm from a little country town called Abbeville, Louisiana. And I'm the father of three beautiful daughters, Naja, who's 26, Heaven, who's 15, and a black belt, 2-degree black belt in karate. I always got to say that because, you know, and all my 11-year-old. And let's see, I'm single. I'm a single man. I've been divorced now for about maybe 11 years. But me and their mother has a very good relationship where we co-parent real well. And I say that and mention that because that has taken so much stress off my life, the idea that me and her could still be friends even though the marriage didn't work, that our friendship as two adult human beings works well for the sake of our kids and for the sake of their prosperity and health. And that has been a tremendous blessing. I'm the CEO of the Soul Focus Group, as you mentioned. And, you know, my life is filled with so many different ups and downs and roller coaster route. But I'm at the point in my life where I figured it out. And I think when you figure stuff out, you can really start enjoying your life. It takes a minute to figure things out because there's so many distractions in the world that's working to get your attention off of you. Because the only math problem you ever have to figure out is yourself. Right? And until you figure out yourself, you're wasting time. Because the only math problem you're here to work on is you. So, and you get the universe pay you to figure out your math problem.
Wow.
Yeah, that's literally, it's going to pay you dividends. When you figure out your math problem, that's when you start getting paid.
And that alludes to a lot of times, you know, in my teaching, I talk about our gifts and our abilities. And I think a lot of people take those for granted as just, oh, I'm just good at that. But the fact that you're great at that, but somebody else isn't, can directly lead to you being compensated for that. Is that kind of what you were harking to?
Yeah, I'm harking to the idea that whatever you're here to do, your why. Everybody has a why. We came here for why, on the request of why. God said, well, I want you to go into the world. You say, why, God? This is why. And then you came here to take care of that why. So we all hear why, but because of the transition from spiritual being into physical form, we go through a period of spiritual amnesia before we wake up again. So we fall asleep in order to be born into this form. Then we wake up, and we wake up to our why. What the world does, it distracts you from discovering your why, because until you discover your why, the world has the right to use you as it sees fit until you have use for yourself. And most people spend most of their life being used by the world because they haven't figured out what use they have of themselves. Once you figure out what your use is for you, now you can start getting paid. Mm. And the universe is only going to pay you for the why that you came here for.
And that's interesting you say that, because one principle that I learned from you specifically was, and you put it in analogy form, and you were basically saying, I think you called it the cosmic superstore.
Yeah.
Talking about the cosmic superstore, and that was years and years and years ago, basically saying that before we came into this physical realm, we were spiritual beings before, we're spiritual beings after. But before we came here, and I'm gonna ask you to speak on this in a minute. Basically, before we came here, you decided on a mission. So once you decided what the mission was, you went to this cosmic superstore and you told the creator, hey, in order to do what I agree to do, I need this. I need these talents, skills, and abilities and all that before I go there. And a lot of times when I tell people about that, it sounds like a woo-woo to them. But to me, it makes perfect sense. So could you elaborate on the cosmic superstore a little bit?
Yeah, you know, the cosmic superstore is something that I imagine to create an image in people's minds to be able to envision how we chose the constructs of our life. And those constructs are show up in your zodiac, in your astrology alignment. If you ever done an astrology reading and you see where your planets are aligned, and all those things represent the influences on your life that ultimately represent choices that you made about your why. Like what things, what attributes and characteristics and strengths and weaknesses you wanted to have in order to be able to do your job. So if you ever did a reading on your astrological reading, a natal chart, as they call it, natal chart, you would see. In fact, I just got through doing one today. Somebody, you know, Brother Bilal, one of my close brothers.
I remember him.
Did a new one on me, right? Did a new one on me. And he said, well, I think it's inauguration day. And I need to give you an up-to-date reading on where you are, right? Because you are connected to other people. See, your why is connected to other people's why. Now, that's heavy.
It is.
Our why has been connected from the very beginning. Why you say, well, man, we like brothers. Yeah, we just like brothers because our why is connected. And when we start accepting responsibility for why we're here, it holds other people accountable for why they're here.
Oh, wow. And I'm glad you brought up the fact that today is inauguration day. So I said, you know what? I'm going to go look up the etymology of inauguration. And it's basically a ceremony that marks the start of something new. A ceremony that marks the start of something new. And I was like, we all need to have our own personal inauguration.
This is inauguration day for all of us.
I'm like, this. So when it said that, then I'm bringing you on. I'm like, because, and I go back to meeting you. I know that you helped me usher in a new iteration of myself. So that's why I thought this was fitting. But I want to take a second. Now, we talk about the Soul Focus Group. Now, when I first met you, you were doing more so personal mindset coaching, things of that nature, which everybody needs that. Everybody needs personal development. Right. Everybody needs that. But you've since evolved into the Soul Focus Group, specifically talking about racism, race relations, and basically taking the personal development core of that to cure the racism on the outside. Is that basically how I understand it?
Yeah, that's close to it. What I did was, I think I was like spiritually conscious before I was socially conscious.
I agree with that.
And spiritually conscious meaning I was aware of my relationship with myself, because spirituality is really your relationship with yourself. It's not a religion. And how well you know yourself and how good you are at getting yourself to do what you want yourself to do will really the measure of your spirituality. It's not how many times you go to church, how many hymns you could sing, how many scriptures you could read. The true measure of your spirituality is getting yourself to do what you want yourself to do. If you wake up in the morning and say, today I'm going to change my diet. Let's say changing your diet is going right. Right. And you wake up and you go left. And you say the next day, nah, I'm telling you, I'm going right today. And you wake up and you go left. And you wake up and you go left. And you keep promising yourself you're going to go right. So until you learn how to get yourself to go right when you say you want to go right, your spirituality is not intact. In other words, the relationship with yourself is not intact. So when I started working, became socially conscious, social justice conscious, I noticed that in the community, there was no spiritual consciousness. There was all social consciousness, but no spiritual consciousness. And what I also noticed that in the spiritual justice community, there was no social consciousness. So they both was missing the two.
Oh, wow.
So what I did is integrated them, integrated social consciousness with spiritual consciousness and vice versa. And what it did is brought a whole new level of understanding to this. The missing understanding that was that needed to be there was is now there. So now you're not just the idea of looking at transforming systems and institutions because racism exists in systems and institutions. But you also are transforming the people that make up the systems and institutions, which is a spiritual act, right? So people will focus on changing the buildings and the computer systems and what they call the institution, but they don't realize the institutions are made up of people and get their power from people. So if you don't transform the minds of the people, nothing will change. You know, and what we just got through seeing the last 4 years have been you getting a chance, us getting a chance to see the mindset of the people,
right?
That needs to be transformed. And you could put as many different presidents as you want in that position until the masses of the people, their mind has changed, nothing is going to change.
Oh, wow.
And hopefully this president could begin to bring about a spiritual and social revolution or involution. You know?
Oh, wow. Okay. So with that being your current work now, I know you did a lot of different things to get there, but I want to take it all the way back. So when you were a little boy growing up in Abbeville, was there an event or a moment where you knew you would be doing something like what you're doing right now?
Oh, no. Yeah, that's a good question, because when I was 5 years old, I had a vision, one of those waking visions, like you're not asleep, but you're like in a trance. And I saw myself teaching millions of people. And what it would do was, by the time I reached the age of 8, because I didn't know how I was going to get done what I saw in the vision, it sent me into depression. So I would be in depression for 16 years following that, because I could not see how I was going to get that huge thing I saw in my vision done. I was like, ain't no way in the world I'm going to do that. And then what it did was, I remember there was an event where the street we lived on, right next, the next street over, because you know, in some of the black communities you have is sort of ghetto, and then you go one street over and it's, you know, a whole different kind of reality where white folks live.
Right.
So there was a little white kid, his name was Clay, that I would go play with. And every time I go to his house, he had a big old boat. His parents had a big old boat, big old house, nice cars. You go inside, there's plenty of food. And here we are, me and my two brothers living, and my older sister living with my mother in a one bedroom shotgun house. We're damn near starving, nothing to eat. So I go there and I was like, this shit ain't adding up to me in my mind. And what wasn't adding up to me was I was trying to understand what God's role was in this. And I would go through a period where I was like, you couldn't get me to believe in that God was not that God was just. I didn't believe God was just. I believed God was unjust.
I agree.
Because I thought to myself, if this is the setup, then God can't be just to set something like this up. You know, so I would begin to start questioning the traditional mindset around God and what we were taught about God. And I remember having a conversation with my great grandmother where she was telling me, you're not supposed to question God. And I said, we used to call her mama. I said, well, mama, if we can't question God and God knows everything, then we in trouble. If we can't ask the entity that's supposed to know everything, you know, we are definitely in a bad spot. So that for me began my journey. And the depression was a part of that journey.
And
I mean, 16 years of that. Yeah.
Wow. And I think a lot of us are walking around with undiagnosed depression, because I had depression myself first, but we were always told, be tough, stick your chest out, just take it, boy, run through it. You know, I was even told by my family members that, boy, you're not depressed. That's not real. And I'm like, okay, I won't share that. I won't share that shit again at all. So why do you think we have such a barrier for getting like mental health healing or even addressing that? There, I mean, think about the trauma we've experienced for centuries. It's gotta be somewhere in us that's still making us be afraid. It's gotta be something that's still making us not really go for it, because you never know that hand that might be coming. What I guess I'm trying to ask, why is it that we won't get treatment for that, or why we won't even acknowledge it as a real thing?
Because we have this stigma that has been put on us at a very early age, that something is not right with us. There's something not quite right. We're not enough. We're unworthy. We're sinners. That concept, you can't wear that concept of being a sinner without being unworthy. And if you're unworthy, that means you're not enough. That's been subconsciously put into our mind when we were children. So the idea of taking on any kind of what this society has created, a stigma, and say, well, I'm depressed, it's like admitting that there's something wrong with me, when we know on a deeper level there's nothing wrong with us. But we haven't been able to prove it. You get what I'm saying? So I set out to prove there was nothing wrong with me. That became my why.
Okay.
So what myself seeing myself in front of millions of people, teaching millions of people, my why became, I want to go out into the world and reveal to people why there's nothing wrong with them.
Good deal.
And that is what I've been doing. So because we think depression means there's something wrong with us, but depression don't mean there's something wrong with us. Depression means that we're not using our computer right. So if your computer starts blanking off and on, not working right, you ain't gonna get all mad and be ashamed. Oh no, I want to tell you, man, my computer working real bad. I can't, right? You wouldn't take that kind of position.
Right.
Well, because we've been taught to believe that our mind is us. We associate our mind being unwell with who we are. And our mind is not who we are. Our mind is a tool that we use to create what we want for ourselves. And we have an obligation to own our mind and to make sure it's functioning properly. How do you know your mind is functioning properly? Because you can produce the desires of your heart. If you're not able to produce and generate the desires of your heart, your mind is not functioning well. That is not an indictment against you. That's an indictment against your mind.
Wow.
And to fix your mind, you got to get it back from the people who broke it. Hmm. The people who broke your mind are the ones who gave you the message that you weren't enough. And they knew when they were, listen, our parents didn't know, because that was given to them. And they were passing on what was given to them. But the ones who started this knew the effect it was going to have, that if you start doubting yourself, then that leads to living in fear. All fear is created from doubt. So as long as you are in doubt about yourself, you will always be afraid of something.
And then not real fear. Now, I was going to ask, so then if you can get a people to doubt themselves, you can control them simultaneously, right? Wouldn't that be the doorway to controlling them?
Hell yeah. That's the only way to control them. If I get you to be suspicious of you, then you're going to put the monkey wrench in yourself. I don't have to do nothing.
Okay.
So we've been managed in a way where, you know, let me put it this way. I had this lesson when I was 7 years old. It came back to me later on in life, riding the bus. The bus used to pick us up at my grandmother's house, who raised us after we were taken from our mama, because she had been declared an unfit mother. Because she was young, struggling, not knowing what to do as a young parent. So somebody had called the police and we were put in the custody, well, the temporary custody of our grandmother. And so we started going to school from there. The bus would pick us up right on the corner. I get on the bus, it's bus number 5. 5 is my favorite number. It's all been put in my subconscious mind. It's things that we set up for ourselves.
Sure.
Your whole life is things you set up for yourself. Hmm. No part of your life is working against you. All parts of your life are working for you. It's how you set yourself up to come up, right? So I get on the bus and I notice something. I notice the bus driver, when she gets on the open highway, has her foot all the way down in the accelerator. And guess what? The bus don't go any faster than 55 miles an hour. I'm like, as a 7-year-old boy, I'm fascinated by this. I'm trying to figure out, because on the speedometer, 80 is the top speed. She have her foot all the way down in the accelerator, but she's not going any faster than 55. So about 3 days went by, and I remember I sit in the front seat and I whisper to her, I said, Miss Harrington, why the bus don't go faster than 55 and you got your foot all the way on the accelerator? She started laughing. She said, oh boy, that's because there's a governor on the bus. Hmm. I was like, a governor? I was thinking about like the governor in Baton Rouge. You know what I'm saying? She said, no, the governor in this case is a device they put on the engine to prevent the engine from going any faster than 55 miles an hour.
Wow.
And when I became of age, when I woke up again, when I was born again, because you're going to be born again many times. When I was born again the second time, that's the first story came to my mind. It came to my mind and said, oh, that's been the problem. We a governor was put on our mind. Hmm. So even though we are capable of going at light speed, we have been going very slow because why? Guess what the governor is? Doubt.
Hmm. That's good. Yeah, I'm taking notes over here while you're teaching. But I wanted to go back to a point you made to make sure that people really understand it and grasp this, because I think it was deep when you said it. When you said, basically, we remind ourselves of, so like we always call it, you know, happenstance, you know, things of that nature. But what you said is we foreknew before we come here that at certain points in our existence, we were going to need X, Y, Z. So we already set it up beforehand. I'll just say the higher version of ourselves set it up beforehand that they knew, okay, on this day at this time, you're going to need this. On this day at this time, you're going to need this to get out of whatever that predicament is. So am I summarizing what you just said? Basically, we did it ourselves.
Bam, you're hitting on it, bro, because when the Bible says that God knew you from the beginning, the God is talking about is you. It's all of us, this eternal being that we all are, that we've been afraid, made to be afraid to associate ourselves with by this world. So as long as we don't associate, the closest we come to associating ourselves with the divine eternal is we say we are what? It lives in us, but we don't claim to be one with it.
Right.
I'm trying to become one with it. You already one with it already. You know, and you already know yourself. But see, here's the thing. When me and Bilal was talking today, one of the things that we came to a conclusion of is that our greatest issue is that when we endow with ourselves, it gets us to play with ourselves. Mm. And most of us are playing with ourselves. What we are truly capable of achieving is like, oh my God, it would scare the average person if we could look into our lives and see just what we are truly capable of, right? But what we do, we play with ourselves. You knew how great you was a long time ago.
That's a fact. And for whatever reason, I was afraid of it. I was afraid of what people
call playing with. It's called playing with yourself.
I did it for a long time, but in my mind, I always knew I could do this. I could make this kind of money. I could do. I was doing, even several times. You had to remind me of that, like, bro, you tripping? What you doing? And several examples of events that happened in my life, and you just be like, bro, come on, bro. I can't even explain. Look what just happened. How you can't even explain what just happened. I'm sitting there like, oh, okay. Just like.
see, here's the thing. You know, because, you know, me and you walked a long journey together, right? When I say we play with ourselves, we don't take our power serious.
I agree.
Right? So right now, there's people right now listening to us talk, have this conversation, and I'm telling you that you're not taking yourself serious. You're not taking your power serious. The conditions that you're in, you don't have to be in those conditions, but you will continue to be in those conditions as long as you continue to play with yourself. Mm.
And then even for the religious one amongst us, you can even say that as you're playing with God. Same thing.
You really are.
So you praying for all this, you're praying for a breakthrough, and God's like, I already gave you the answer. You already got the answer, but you keep asking me for the answer. So you got a refrigerator full of water, but you're praying to me for water.
Matter of fact, the answer is you. Let me see if I can say it again, and I want y'all to get this. The answer is you. Mm.
So
I'm not your answer. The answer is you. The answer to your life is you.
So going a little deeper, why do you think we why do we play? What are we afraid of? Like, because I can say I was afraid of what people might say, but I think it might be a little bit deeper than I was afraid of what people might say. I think that that's just an excuse that we use.
Right. No, it's real when your mind, when your computer ain't working right. Okay. Keeping in mind that our mind is our computer. And when our computer is not working right, it has tendencies. The first thing that is downloaded into our mind computer is doubt. And doubt causes a virus, just like a virus on your computer, right? How do you know you have that virus? What happens is, just like you have a virus in your body, how does the body react when you have a virus in your body? What's the first thing you get to let you know you're fighting something?
You get a fever.
That's all fear is. Fear is mental fever. Letting you know you got a doubt virus operating in your mind.
Wow.
And until you get rid of that doubt virus, the fever will persist. Until you get to the point to where you stop having a fever and you get numb.
Wow. Fear is a mind virus. I got that.
It's a mind virus, right? No, doubt is a mind virus. Fear is the fever letting you know that you're trying to fight off the virus.
Ah, okay.
All right.
All right.
So what ends up happening is, now look at this. There's two kinds of fear in life. There's the fear of you walk upon a rattlesnake and you see it the last minute, and you jump down it like a rabbit to get out of there, right? Because it scares you to death. Why? It's not really fear in that moment. What it is respect, the utmost of respect, because that animal could kill you, and you know it.
Right.
That's what fear is really supposed to evoke in us, the utmost respect for the thing that could take your life.
Wow.
But that only makes up 2 to 5% of the fear in life. We don't experience that fear every day unless you're living in a combat zone. Hmm. Right?
Yes, sir.
So 95 to 98% of the fear we experience is virtual. It's virtual, man. It's what we think people are going to think about us.
Wow.
It's all perception. 95 to 98% of our fear is perception.
So right? we're also afraid of, we don't want them to know what we think about ourselves.
Because you can't read nobody's mind, can you? Can you read anybody's mind?
No, sir.
So when you say, I know what they're thinking about me, you're lying. You're playing with yourself. You know what you're thinking about you. What you're thinking about you is you are ashamed of, so you're trying to project it onto somebody else. But all you know is that you thinking what you think about yourself. There are 5 levels to the rabbit hole we fall down. And I'm going to show you how we fall down. Because once you got the fever, you got the virus, you get the fever. And as a whole, this is what they, you know, in the story of what's this, the nursery rhyme story where she fall down the rabbit hole. What's her name? You know what I'm talking about. Alice in Wonderland.
Okay.
See, so Alice in Wonderland represents you falling down that hole of doubt and fear. And you end up wondering, what the hell are you here for? You Alice in the Wonderland, where you wondering about yourself, right?
Wow.
And the only way to get out of wondering about yourself is to do what? Stop playing with yourself. So, but here's how you fall. Number one, when what other people think about you becomes more important than what you think about yourself, you're in trouble.
Mm. I hope y'all got that.
That's why Facebook was set up. Because we are more concerned about what other people think about us than what we think about ourselves. Now, if I could get you to bite on that, if I could get you to make what somebody else think as about you as being more important what you think about yourself, I got you.
That's a fact.
I got you. Because now, here's what's going to happen. Once what other people think about me is more important than what I think about myself, how I look going to become more important than how I feel.
So I go out of my way to make sure I'm doing what I think they want from me versus what I want from myself. I mean, that's like social media defined right there.
That's social media. That's how they built social media. So, you know, I'm going broke. Let's say a person going broke, but I'm on Facebook fronting like I got it going on. Hmm. Okay, all right. So you say, well, what's wrong with that? The truth catch up with all of us.
Yes, sir.
Now, how many people you know when they are not living the truth are looking for the truth to catch up with them?
Well, if they're already living it, they don't have to look for it.
Exactly. So anybody who's not living the truth is not looking for the truth to catch up with them. They're running from the truth.
That's a fact.
They're running from it. So if you live your life running from the truth, is there any power in running from your truth?
Nah.
No. Because running from your truth ends up being what? Running from yourself.
And
so while you're caught up in this, you're running from yourself, playing with yourself. And that's like you playing tag with you. You're playing tag with yourself.
That's insanity.
Bro, if you keep running around that thing, it would do that, right? So when what you look becomes more important than what you feel, being right becomes more important than getting what you want.
Yeah, it reminds me of that analogy we talked about a lot of time about Neo running around the subway. He keep running around. He turn around. Damn, I'm still here. He run. Damn, I'm still here. I'm still in the same place.
Yeah, so you imagine you this guy you married, and you're having a bad day at work. And you're thinking while you're at work, man, I could really use a hug from my wife. You know, just a nice hug. And I want her to love up on me because it's a rough day. You get home. Instead of you just saying, honey, can I get a hug? I had a rough day. Your ego won't let you do that. In other words, you're playing with yourself. So you try to make her feel bad about the fact that she ain't been loving up on you. She's been paying attention to everything else. So you create an argument. And you're working to prove that you're right and she wrong.
Right.
And you end up sleeping on the sofa and she in the bedroom, and the hug that you wanted, the simple hug that you wanted, you end up not getting because you could not just come forward and say, be intimate. Honey, I need a hug, right? That's what we do. We make being right more important than getting what we want. Mm. You feel what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
And you can see it in people's lives. There's nothing stopping anybody from getting what they want. I promise you. All of us have a history. When we put our mind to it, we get whatever we want.
You're unstoppable.
There's nobody listening to this right now can prove to me that there's at a time in your life when you really wanted something and you put your mind to it, you didn't get it. Mm. See, we're playing with ourselves. You've seen yourself get what you want when you want to get it. Yes, you've seen yourself go get. You've seen yourself go get a house with no money in your pocket.
That's a fact.
And I've seen it too. And people don't believe that. I've seen this dude with no money in his pocket go and buy, I'm talking about one of them six-figure houses. Now I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Wait a minute. So don't tell me we don't know.
Right.
And we all have stories of miraculous, powerful things that we've achieved when we put our mind to it.
And the only reason we consider it miraculous is because we don't do it a lot. So when we do it every now and then, is when we call it a miracle, when that should be how it is every single day. It shouldn't be a such thing as a miracle. The only reason it's a miracle because we playing with ourselves, God damn it.
Listen, I was playing with myself and went broke. You remember when I went broke, when I lost every dime in my name, and I was getting ready to be homeless, right? Yeah. I went broke because I was playing with myself.
That's a fact.
Universe said, you keep playing with yourself, you'll go broke. I had to file bankruptcy. Literally, I filed bankruptcy. You remember when I filed bankruptcy?
Yes, I do.
I filed bankruptcy, and it was embarrassing. Why? Because I was still caught up in that what people think about me was more important than what I thought about myself.
Right.
And here's where I woke up. I remember driving in the McDonald's drive-thru to get a value menu burger from McDonald's, fry and whatever the cheeseburger is. And the lady said, that'd be $2.02. And I said, oh. It hit me because I forgot I had no money. I was an automatic pilot. I was an automatic pilot in my car, and I just knew I had $2 worth of coins hid somewhere in the car.
Right.
I'm looking all through the car. I have $2 in my name. I had to drive out of the parking lot. But what hit me was when she said that, the first thing I thought about was like, oh shit, what would people think about me if they knew I didn't have $2 in my name?
Right. And
that woke me up.
And just to add emphasis to that, y'all, I want y'all to understand this was a man over 40 years old with three daughters to take care of at the time he's talking about right now. Because I was around when all this stuff happened. So imagine, first of all, thinking, you know, you're a father, you're a provider, and you don't even have $2 to your name. And then secondarily, like he just said, worrying about what people are going to think about me, what people are going to say. But eventually he figured out it didn't matter what people say. Once he decided it didn't matter, the $2 was nothing. And in a short amount of time, money showed up just like that. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, right on point. the thing was, when I say that woke me up, because I didn't know that I had made what other people think about me more important than I think about myself. It was in that moment I became aware that I had made other people's thoughts more important than my thoughts, which meant that I was living for other people, which also meant I was playing with myself. Because you're playing with yourself if you're living for other people. You're playing with yourself. Because when you think people are thinking about you, people ain't thinking about you. You know, sometimes people are thinking about getting boogers out of their nose, getting a wedgie out of their butt, paying their own bills, getting shit straight for themselves. And right. You around here thinking people looking at you. You know, I see sometimes, well, you know, women will take all day, I mean, weeks to find a dress. And she's thinking in her mind, boy, when I put that dress on, I know what everybody going to just fall out when they see me. She walk right. In the party, ain't nobody look at her. That's how we be living our life. From one event to the next, of what we think people going to think about us, that is the ultimate playing with yourself, when how you look is more important than how you feel, what other people think about you is more important than what you think about yourself, and when being right is more important than getting what you want. So you got to stay focused on what you want, right? And then so I went down to zero, huh?
And that a pool becomes somewhat of a narcotic. But you were saying you went down to zero, but take us to that point of zero, and you at zero, and you looking up. The only way you can look is up. What's going through your mind at that moment to let you know what? Okay, I'm at zero, so what? Now I got to go for it. Take us to that moment.
That moment, I'm sitting on the edge of my bed, and I'm sad. I'm sad, and I'm mad at myself because I you know, they say that, you know, the prodigal son finds himself in the hog pen, mm-hmm. and he comes to himself. I come to myself and I'm like, shit, I've been playing with myself for too damn long.
Right.
So I asked self, I said, higher self, how do I get out of this? Immediately came to me. Says, you know, get some money and take out life insurance policies on yourself and make your children beneficiary, right? Now, a lot of people think, you know, in the Black community, having life insurance policies ain't no popular thing.
No.
It is not no popular thing, because in our mind, we have been socialized to think that if I get a life insurance policy, I'm betting against myself. Mm-hmm. So that was in my mind. I'm like, a life insurance policy. So I'm thinking, first of all, I didn't have no money. Well, I'm going to get some money from the life insurance policy. So I end up, I'm sitting on the couch, and I'm, for some reason, the remote was dropped or something. I dig into the sofa and I found a ring that I own. Nice ring when I had money. So I pawned it and took out like two or three life insurance policies on myself and put my girls as the beneficiary. I felt good about myself. I say, well, if I left today, my girls would be taken care of. I'm on the right road. And then I got a phone call to do a workshop in Seattle. So now I'm putting all this together and I'm kind of spooky because I'm still playing with myself a little bit. So I get on the plane. And I start thinking, wait a minute, my spirit said to take out a life insurance policy on myself, put my girls as beneficiary. I'm getting on a plane. I'm like, oh shit, I'm ready to check out. I'm paranoid. I'm sitting on the plane, paranoid as all I do. I'm sitting down to myself, like, oh shit, this could be it. This could be, because you know, older people tell you about the moment when they knew somebody in their family was getting ready to leave, they said things and then they left.
Right.
And I was like, is that moment for me? Is that the moment for me? And I'm sitting on the plane. I'm looking at everybody. And I was like, oh, man, this could be that moment. And guess what that voice inside of me said? It's my higher self said. When in your life have you ever known how much time you have left to live?
Never.
Never. That hit me like a mule in my head. I'm like, damn, well, I ain't never knew. So we've been playing like we think we got all the time in the world.
Right.
And none of us do. So then my higher self say to me, says, everybody on this plane is playing Russian roulette with their time.
Wow.
Because ain't nobody on this plane know how much time they have left.
That's a fact.
Make a long story short, when I got off that plane, I had a new fervor for life. And that fervor was to show up 100. And when I went in and did that workshop, I was off the chain. When I say I was off the chain, they were like, who are you? Because I had been holding back. I had been holding my bird in the cage.
Right.
But I let him out.
And see, what a lot of people don't understand is, as speakers and presenters and coaches and all that, it's one thing for people to tell you off the chain. But when you feel it yourself, you know it's a totally different being. You're a totally different being when you know for yourself. I don't even care what they say. I know I just tore that son of a bitch up. That's the best feeling in the world.
And so, look, I'm gonna tell y'all something. From that moment, I went from zero to past six figures in 30 days.
Wow.
In 30 days. Money started raining from everywhere. And I was like, I got the message. See, I set it up for myself. Say, when you come out of the closet, I'm going to pay you.
Hmm. Which goes back to the point you were making earlier. You already foreknew.
Man, you already did this already. You already did this. You put your money up before you came here. You created your wealth before you came here. And don't let people get you to believe it ain't true. There's not a single being in human form that is not wealthy.
Mm.
Do not believe in that garbage. There's no God that's walking around here, bro.
No.
You broke because you're playing with yourself. Wow. Stop playing with yourself. Stop taking yourself serious. You go from zero to 60 in a minute.
And talking about that wealth mindset, and I'm pretty sure this happened to you in your life. Ever since I was a little boy, I didn't know how I was going to do it or what it was going to be. I knew I was going to be wealthy. Could walk. I just knew. And you mentioned one of the stories about, you talk about your neighbor with the house. Well, I tell this story a lot. I was like in seventh grade or so, you know, I was in all of the science club, junior historians, all that kind of stuff, yada, yada, yada. And I was trying to get to know people because where I'm from, it was four elementaries and one middle school. So everybody comes to the same school. So I'm trying to get to know people. So,
right.
And a lot of these groups that, you know, junior historians, I'll let you, I'm like, I'm the only black person, or at least the only black guy. So we had a Christmas party one time, and we went to one of the members' Christmas party. And I'll never forget walking in. First of all, it was on Mystic Lane. So we turned on Mystic Lane. I'm like, oh, shit, okay. So I remember walking in the front door. First thought to myself as a seventh grader was, my whole house will fit in their living room.
Wow.
And I made it up in my mind at that point. Now, I know these people are not smarter than me because I'm in classes with all of them. I they don't treat me differently or whatever. They just have some information that I don't have. That's all they have, I don't have, because it's not the intellect, it's not the presentation ability, it's not the social ability. They just have access to something I don't have. And I decided in seventh grade, whatever that shit is, I'm going to figure it out. And that's kind of where I got triggered early in my life. But I just always knew it was going to be there. And by no means are either one of us where we eventually want to be, but we sure ain't where we used to be. So When did you first know in your life, you can go back as far as you want to go, that you knew at some point you were going to be wealthy?
Well, because I literally felt in my spirit that every time I put my hands in my pocket, there was $1 million there.
Mm, okay.
And I would literally walk into places feeling like a wealthy man when I was like down to zero. Even when I was down to zero, I still felt wealthy because I was in touch with my wealth. I was playing with myself, but I was in touch with my wealth, but I was still playing with myself. And when you're playing with yourself, you don't have authorization to get all of your money.
Hmm.
As long as you're playing with yourself, you don't have you have denied yourself authorization, because you have to be authenticated, right? There's an authentication process. It's like you go to the Pentagon and you want to go up to certain levels, you got to have clearance levels, and there's certain clearance levels you have to get to certain parts in the Pentagon. It's the same thing in your life. There are certain clearance levels, and you said it, so it's like certain levels of you stop playing with yourself and being honest with yourself,
right,
that you start gaining access to your wealth, your real wealth.
Absolutely. And you talk about points along the way, and I just wanted to say this with a tremendous amount of gratitude. I remember this is about 2008, 2009 or so. And this is like when we first started becoming cool, because we had been kind of hit and miss for 3 or 4 years or whatever. And I just remember you asked me to come take a ride with you. We was at Starbucks. And you took me and bought me a shirt and a pair of pants and some shoes. You remember that? I remember that.
Yeah.
And I was like, I never asked for it. He was like, well, you need a certain, you know, you like, you're a handsome guy, you're professional, you're on the brink, but you need to look the part. So you bought me a couple of pair of shoes, a couple of shirts, and a couple of pair of pants. And I was like, and that was about us even. I hadn't really known you that much, but you just saw something in me. So I'm just standing to say, sometimes it takes somebody else for you to lean on their confidence in you until you catch up with it yourself. Because at that point, like you said, I was playing myself at that point.
And see, the thing is like sometimes some people will show you how serious you are, even when you're playing with yourself.
That's a fact.
You know what I'm saying? You meet people, because I've had people in my life that saw how serious I was in terms of the role I come into this world to play. not just for myself, but my connection to other people, that they, like Bilal, my brother Bilal and his brother Jafar, when I was living in New Orleans, when I went through a period of a little down period, they would pick me up and one day pick me up and say, where are we going? Don't worry about it. We're going to the mall. Just walk around with. And they bought me a whole wardrobe of clothes. And I was like, man, why y'all doing this? Because we know what you come here to do and you got to get busy doing it. See, they were taking me serious and I wasn't taking myself.
We all do it. But the point I want to make to a lot of people that's listening, it's okay to go through stuff. You know, people want to avoid the pain and the process and the valleys. People want to go through that. Now, I want you to share with us how important it is for you to go through it. You know, the old folks say it's okay to go through hell as long as you keep going. So I know that in my life, I've learned a lot more from when I was down than when I was up. So talk about the valley and how important that is to like the ultimate destination, ultimate growth.
Wow. I grew up in hell. You know, the situations that I grew up in, me and my brothers, the level of poverty was like, ooh, to just give you a glimpse. Everybody else was living pretty good. To get water just to be able to cook or take a bath. And we didn't have a bathtub. My grandmother didn't have a bathtub in the house. It was one there, but it didn't work. It wasn't set up. And there were a lot of holes in the house. So to take a bath, we had to stand at the face bowl in the bathroom and bathe. That's how we bathed up until I was 16 years old and went off to college. To get water, we had to go outside to outside faucet and put water in a 5-gallon bucket and bring enough water in the house to flush the toilet that, by the way, was not connected either. So it was no inside really running plumbing. So the pressure from the water we pour in the toilet would flush your turds away, right? Same thing with cooking. We had to get water from outside. That's how we lived every day in, like, you know, living in the third world kind of poverty.
Right.
And I remember the turning point for me was me and my best friend, his name is Keith Roy. Keith Roy is no longer with me, but me and him were good friends. He lived behind our house. And there was a area with bamboo and stuff. And somebody had planted some marijuana back there. And I guess they forgot about it, or maybe they got arrested or something. So me and him found the marijuana and we started scheming. I didn't know nothing about what marijuana was. He knew a little bit about it, but we both young experiment. So we end up baking it and we both end up having a bag apiece of marijuana. And I remember seeing my uncles and smoke marijuana and all this other stuff. And I was like, man, maybe they know something I don't know about how to get out of this. Because I'm thinking the drugs were going to be the escape out of the problems we were in.
Right.
You follow me? So me and Keith rode our bikes to the park. And we would sit in the dugout and we both smoked our whole bag. He smoked his bag, I smoked my bag. I could barely hold a bicycle up. So check it out. We made it back home. I got off my bike, got in my grandmother's house, I sit down on the couch, and I was like, oh shit, ain't nothing changed. This is still the same house, still the same condition. That was the first time I woke up. And I was like, because I realized, like, this is not the way out, because I thought using drugs was the way out, literally, because I had cousins and I had friends who would get on the bus every day to go to school and they would drink down alcohol just to numb themselves to deal with the reality they were dealing with. So I was trying to get out. That's what football came as an option. When I saw that football was going to be a way I could get out, I could get a scholarship. Somebody told me you get a scholarship. I focused my mind on that because I wanted to get my brothers out and that would be a way to get out.
Sure.
So. But that was when I first, you know, came to some light as it relates to all of this.
Good. And I want to move into, since we have 49 minutes now, so we're getting close to our time. But I think it's important, especially in 2021, with the work that you and the Soul Focus Group are doing right now, because it's like, if there's nothing more timely than the work y'all doing with racism and you know, sharing it to you in the audience, the crowd that you share it with and your coaching students and things of that nature. Why is racism so at the forefront right now? Was there a shift somewhere? Because as black men, we know it's always been there, but it seems like white people still want to deny it's there. And when we try to express that it's still there, they just want to ignore it or tell us to shut up or whatever. Why is it at the forefront right now?
Well, I'm gonna say this is at the forefront because pioneers like Ron Chisholm and Dr. Kimberly Richards and Diana Dunn and pioneers that have been around for David Billings with the People's Institute and a whole bunch of other people that have been doing work on the battlefield for years and years and years, pushing and pushing the issue. Them pushing the issue has brought about not just them, but people of their age group, of their generation, working to make people consciously aware, set us on fire, set my generation on fire around it. And we got the idea and start joining the fray, so to speak. And that has been in the background working to bring about transformation. And oftentimes transformation, when it starts happening for real, it goes through a period, an ugly period. So people think transformation is all beautiful, but you have a lot of disease that you got to get rid of. And when that disease starts coming out of the body, it comes out ugly. What we are seeing now is the disease that's been deep in the body of America that now is coming out as a result of the work being done for so many years. So we've joined on to the work. I've been doing the work, like you said, for 30 years as a life coach and 25 years in the social justice movement around racism. And we're still learning, but people are now beginning to see that you can't keep stealing resources from people, because that's essentially what's been set up. People of color, we've been paying taxes in this country the whole time, and we have not been receiving the services that we deserve for the taxes we pay. So the police departments have not worked for us like they work for white people, the fire departments, et cetera, et cetera. Every institution, healthcare system, that's why our numbers are bad across the board in every institution and system,
right?
Because we've been paying for stuff but not receiving the services at the same quality as white people. Why? Because this country was set up on a racial hierarchy, and now people are waking up to it, right? So the first 25 years for me was about convincing white people that racism was real. White people didn't want to believe that. They didn't want to believe it was real. And I can understand why they would not want to believe racism is real. Because it's like saying to you, you keep winning a race and you find out the race was rigged. Are you gonna be happy to find out that you didn't really beat all them brothers in that race?
Absolutely.
That race was fixed. You wouldn't want to know that. So they have not wanted to know that the race was fixed.
Wow.
But the race has been fixed.
That would make me doubt myself.
Huh?
That would make me doubt myself.
We didn't know, because most of us didn't know the race was fixed. We thought we were gonna actually get a chance to win. We didn't know they picked the winners before the race started. See, they've been picking the winners before the race started a long time ago. They picked who's going to be wealthy, who wasn't going to be wealthy. Then every now and then they pick a few people of color to window dress to get us to believe that, oh yeah, you can too. Listen, you can if you write your own script. If you follow the script that's been laid out, it's only a certain amount of people that's going to be able to achieve their wealth if you follow the script. But if you create your script, it's unlimited.
And I know I want to see if we can do it this way. If you would, we got black and white people both watching us. And as far as racism is concerned, I think one side has to understand the other and vice versa, or something to that effect. So if you would speak first to black people and racism and what they should know and how they should embrace it. And then secondly, speak to white people and how they should embrace it, so that at some kind of way we can meet in the middle, because we none of us going nowhere. So at some point, right, it's got to be give and take, and at some point we got to be able to get together somewhere.
Right. Well, for black people, we have been in the social construct or the racial construct, but black is at the bottom. We have been the anchor that holds it down. We've been the ones who had it the worst next to Native Americans. Native Americans oftentimes not even put in the conversation.
Right.
But you have to put Native Americans and blacks in the same conversation, because of course they have almost been completely annihilated from the force of the Europeans hitting the shore. Now, we've been at the bottom, but we have to really become self-determined, right? Because the reason why we stay at the bottom, because we follow the subconscious programming that came along with us being at the bottom.
Right.
We have to create some new programming, some new socialization for ourselves that takes the governor off the engine of our bus and allows us to have the freedom to really create what we're in the level we are capable of. In other words, as black people, we got to start taking ourselves serious.
And
we really got to see how powerful we are. And as white people, white people really need to take the opportunity, and I call it the opportunity because it's grace. Because the reality is we're not minorities. Black and brown people are not minorities. We make up the majority of people in the world. People of color outnumber white people 11 to 1. And this world has becoming more and more globalized, which means we are more connected to people of color around the world already.
Right.
So what white people need to do is study and understand the history of America and understand how white was created. White ain't even real. When Europeans first came to the shores, they came as what? Irish, Italian, Germans, Jews, et cetera, et cetera. They weren't white. They didn't come as white. White was something invented in the House of Burgess in 1691. They created the concept of white, and then they would make certain groups of European white at different times. So the Irish became white at a different time as the Jews, Italians, et cetera. No, none of them became white at the same time. If you don't have to believe me, go look it up yourself. When did Joe people become white? Now, for Europeans to become white, they had to do what? Disconnect from their heritage, from their ethnicity, from their spiritual connection. So, the research shows in about three generations, the only thing left from their ancestry is a recipe. It takes three generations to have it melted out. That's called assimilation. So, but what white people don't know is that there's a price for that. There's a price for becoming white. And the price for becoming white was giving up your connection to the rest of humanity.
Wow. That's strong. That...
Yeah. So now they need to be working to reclaim their family connection.
Right.
You know, and people of color need to be working to reclaim their family connection, because our family connection has been thrown off because we've been trying to follow the ways of white people.
That's
when we have been, we got to get out of that. We got to come back to ourselves. Take yourself serious. Stop playing with yourself. And recognize that who we are is natural leaders.
Right.
Not because of ego, just because that's who we are.
That's right.
Not because we're trying to prove something to people, just who we are. We all need each other. We all play a role. White people play a role, right? But they have to rejoin the human family.
I remember us, I don't know, like maybe 5 or 6 years ago, having this conversation, and you were like, and we were talking about business and, you know, that kind of thing. And you were like, I don't think I really just want to do anything on race. I've done this for years or whatever. What kind of flipped you back and be like, okay, this is the time is now.
Well, I saw that subconsciously, the program that's holding us back is tied to race.
Okay.
And it's like, for people of color, we've been rejected. You know, think about maybe a woman or a dude who's been rejected by their lover. And instead of saying, thank you for redirecting me, you're saying that you really don't, we're not good for each other. When you're not in your right mind, what you end up doing? Chasing behind them more.
Facts.
Right? When they reject you, chase behind them more. So what happened to us not being in our right mind, when they rejected us, we have been chasing behind white people ever since then to try to prove to them that we are fully human.
That was a nugget.
We have made them the standard by which to judge how we are doing. And so we've been doing so much performing. Most of our life is about performing for white people. And what you're seeing is the universe saying, all this shit got to stop.
Right.
I need human beings to come back to being fully human, because race and racism took us all out of our humanity. And we all have to return to full humanity. And returning to full humanity is returning to the reality that each human being is God. It's a different expression of God. And to start treating each human being like God and get out of this foolishness that we've been practicing, that is now ran out of time. We out of time. We in a new day. If you don't create a new reality for yourself, shame on you.
That's why today is Inauguration Day.
It's Inauguration Day.
So last question, because our time is winding up. So you got Soul Focus Group going. You're still a relatively young man. What's the next 10 or 20, 30 years look like for Berg Davenport? You got this great thing going. You're passionate about it. It's profitable. It's doing well. You've been through your trials and tribulations. I don't want to say you're on cruise control, but you're on an ascending, still on an ascending path. You know, the bumps and the bruises, you already got over all that. What do you see for the next 10 or 20 years? Where do you want to take this whole thing?
I want to transfer as much of the knowledge I have in my head to as many people as possible so that this thing will continue. I want to continue to work with leaders who are leaders that will go out into the world who are not playing with themselves. And when I keep using the term playing with yourself, what I'm saying is allowing your ego to keep you distracted. Because when you're in your ego, you're playing with yourself.
Right.
Right. So I want to depart as much as possible. I want to create an institute where we're training and developing leaders globally to be able to have an understanding of who they are, to go out and do some very powerful things. People of all races that see beyond this racial construct and what it has done to our humanity. And so we can reclaim it, as we say, recover it, recover our humanity. So that's why I see myself. And, you know, in terms of wealth, it's beyond the wealth beyond imagination is already, it's already here, it's already developing.
Yes, sir.
But to be able to house it in ways where we're teaching people how to bring wealth out of themselves. Because as you say, and you have the perfect way you talk about it, the wealth is in you. You got to get to know you to get the wealth out of you.
Right.
Right. So everybody's looking outside themselves for wealth, and ain't no wealth outside of you. There's no wealth outside of you. Hmm. The wealth you see outside of you belong to somebody else.
That's a fact.
It belongs to somebody else. So yeah. If you want to have your own wealth, you got to take it out of you. There's an idea you came into this world to create wealth for yourself with, and you got to form you, right? So I look at people as the soil, right? Hmm. That you plant in. So right now we're planting. Right now we're planting in the minds of people, the soil of people. But the soil has been poisoned. We got to heal the minds of the people so that we can plant into each other, and what we plant grows.
Mm. Yeah, and that saying is, to build wealth, you got to first build yourself. That's the saying. And ladies and gentlemen, I can't add no more to that. I told y'all it was going to be hot fire. And we could actually do this 2 or 3 more hours, because we both like sharing experiences and things of that nature. But soulfocusgroup.com is .com or .org? It's .com, right?
.com is a soul focused group. ED, soulfocusedgroup.com. Yeah. Check out our podcast. We have a podcast and everything too.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, promo it out. What are you here they can check out?
Podcast. We have a new book that's going to be coming out. It's called Genius, Originality, Distinction, The Monarch Way, and the Butterfly Bible Book. I'm excited about the Butterfly Bible Book because it uses the analogy of the caterpillar butterfly as to link to the journey that we go through in our life. You know, some of us have extended our stay as a caterpillar when we should have become a butterfly a long time ago.
Wow.
So the Butterfly Bible is really how you become a butterfly after being a caterpillar for too damn long.
And so for those people who are leaders of organizations and things, that they could contact you guys about possibly doing some racism training with them and things of that nature. Yes. I believe you do some leadership training and things of that nature also. But guys, go to Soul Focused Group, F-O-C-U-S-E-D, group.com. Get in contact with them. I've been to several of his seminars. There it is.
That's our logo. That's our logo.
That is awesome.
And the reason why we got this queen on our shirt, because it is the time of she.
Mm. That's
it
a fact.
Is the feminine energy time, and we want to support that because we know women have been oppressed, and it's so beautiful thing to see Kamala Harris be lifted up into the vice presidency. Right? That's inauguration day. That's a new day. That's showing us it's a new day. Now we got to take advantage of it, not just because that's just symbolic.
Right.
We got to make the symbolism real.
That's a fact. But ladies and
we
gentlemen,
we got to make the symbolism real.
Our time is winding up. And he has other things he has to go do. It's been Berg Davenport. Like, he find him on all social media. He's out there. He publishes a lot of things. He does videos. They got a podcast. Check the website out. It's been Norris and Norris Network again. We're going to keep doing these. And if he's gracious enough, he may come do a part 2 for us. Because like I said, we could do this hours on hours in. I appreciate it. I appreciate your time.
Appreciate you, brother.
It's been wonderful. So everybody like, share, comment, let everybody know about it. We're trying to grow the community. We love you, and we'll see you next time.
Peace.